Our next case is number 23-12580, ECB USA et al. Versus Savencia Cheese USA et al. Mr. Marco.
May it please the court, David Marco on behalf of the plaintiffs and appellants in this case, ECB USA and Atlantic Ventures. Your Honor, this is primarily a case that involves the long arm statute, section 1B, whether or not a party committed a tortious act within the state of Florida. The principal issue is whether this group of co-conspirators, as alleged in the complaint, committed torts directed at the state. If any co-conspirator committed a substantial act directed at Florida, then there is personal jurisdiction as to all co-conspirators. In fact, so long as not contradicted by a relevant affidavit or a provision in one of those affidavits, those allegations are sufficient for us to have prevailed in the court below.
But at the time of the fraud, as alleged in the complaint, when the fraud, let's break it up into time segments. At the time the fraud began, as alleged in the complaint, there was no connection to Florida, right? I mean, no company was based in Florida. No defendants were based in Florida. The plaintiffs and their shareholders, owners, principals were not based in Florida, right? Nobody was based in Florida at the beginning.
So, no, Your Honor. At the time the conspiracy started, the answer to that question is true. At the time that the fraud commenced, it is not true. So, the fraud begins on October 1st, not 2014, when the letter of intent is created for the purposes of and is transmitted to Florida to Mr. Freeman, who was local deal counsel in Florida. And that letter of intent had two fraudulent statements in it. The first one is that Mr. Voss was the ensconced day-to-day manager of the company, CEO and president. The second one is that the losses that had been explained subsequently, even verbally, were attributable to utilizing that subsidiary that was being sold as essentially a zombie entity, buy for a dollar, sell for a dollar, and therefore the losses were artificial. And those two frauds were in the LOI and were transmitted into the state of Florida to Mr. Freeman, who was not casual. He was local deal counsel. And so the frauds are the series of events that are essentially a continuing fraud that begin in the fall of 2014.
What else has a connection to Florida?
Oh, plenty, Your Honor. So Mr. Freeman received multiple drafts of a purchase agreement, each containing, as stated in the complaint and very particularly identified, fraud after fraud after fraudulent statement. Company is operating in the ordinary course of business. That there has been no substantial changes to the company's operations or management, et cetera, et cetera. None of that was true. So if we go back in time at the beginning of the conspiracy, what happens? So on June 30th, 2014, as alleged in the complaint, Mr. Voss is sacked, removed completely as CEO and president of the company and is left only nominally in a position for purposes of trying to find a pigeon to sell the company to and otherwise had no meaningful role in the operation of the business.
Were those documents also sent to others aside from Mr. Freeman, like the principals of the plaintiffs?
I'm sure that they were. They were accessed by various people, but the deal counsel who was...
Fraud committed in Florida?
Because if a fraud is committed in Florida and Georgia, it is also committed in Florida.
Can you answer this? And this is not a well-formed thought. I'll just preface it by saying that. one of the arguments from the other side and something that the district court sort of hit on is it just seems odd that the location of the deal counsel for a deal that was negotiated in France and didn't have Florida entities involved with it would be dispositive for personal jurisdiction, given that the defendants didn't choose the deal counsel. have they really purposefully availed themselves of the state where the deal counsel happens to be located? Like, what do you say with just that concern that this is sort of, I don't know, it's kind of random?
So it's very far from random. So the purchase agreement, every draft of it, it's also stated in the complaint, identified that Miami would be the place of closing. The two buyer entities are to Florida.
Miami could be the place of closing, right?
No, it would be, is what it says. And it happened to be.
But it wasn't. It was virtual.
So that's an interesting question, Your Honor. So here we are in the modern world. Just because a transaction occurs virtually doesn't mean it doesn't still involve human beings. Mr. Freeman is identified, and it's pled in the complaint, that he was the closing agent. He received the documents in Miami, Florida. He received the money in Miami, Florida, $2 million in 2014, $15 million in 2015, in the second half of the closing, after the headquarters even had already been moved to Florida in January of 2015. And so when money flows through those accounts, documents and due diligence flow through the Miami, Florida lawyers, it isn't just a coincidental thing. So there's this New Mexico case, the name escapes me, where counsel is in New Mexico, but all of the events happened in somewhere in the Midwest. That is not this instance. ECB USA and Atlantic Ventures are Florida companies.
Well, they are now, I mean, right? I mean,
in December of 2014. And Voss was already president of those companies on December 9th of 2014, or December 5th, maybe, of 2014. The point is that the continuation of the frauds that began in the fall of 2014 continued to go on and on and on, including into 2015. So when $15 million is paid from a Florida account, that is and so as this court has held, an injury in Florida is the same as an act directed at the state of Florida. So even just those two payments alone is sufficient to establish it.
Well, let me ask you a question. You know, I'm supposed to look at the traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice. We've all agreed the individual defendants, at least at the time, didn't reside in Florida. And this action largely duplicates an action already pending in Delaware. Why does the exercise of personal jurisdiction over these individual defendants comport with traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice?
Well, so if I could quote Judge Jordan in DeValle, Expedia was not in Florida, but the injuries that occurred in Florida were sufficient to meet those standards. In this case, we have the same situation, because what respectfully Judge Jordan said is it was reasonable for Expedia to expect that their website would be accessed in Florida. In this case, every draft of the purchase agreement says Morgan Lewis, Miami, Florida.
But Expedia in that case targeted Florida residents through their advertising, and so there was purposeful availment, because it wasn't just that they had a website that was accessed in Florida, it was also that they were specifically targeting Florida residents with their advertisements, and thereby expecting that at least some Florida residents would book vacations with them. Is this case the same or similar?
So Lee Ciadelli is the same, a single act directed at the state of Florida, but we're not that limited. In this case, you have the parties intentionally expecting that this transaction would close in Florida. That's significantly different than not having any idea and it's just like a random event that it happened to happen in South Florida. They knew that Mr. Freeman was accessing the data room that contained continual statements of fraud. Two documents in the data room, one that says that Voss is the CEO and president of the company, and a second one which identifies nobody else that's actually running the company inside the data room that was downloaded. They gave him access to that data room. It is reasonable under constitutional analysis that when somebody gives a Floridian access to a data room, that agent, for the disclosed principal accessing it from that state, they knew that they were committing a tort in the state. And that's all 2014, Your Honors. Okay, think about 2015.
Stop right there, because I want to, can you give him an extra minute, Stephanie, please?
Oops, I'm so sorry.
No, you didn't go over your time. I'm giving you an extra minute because I want you to discuss the 12B6 dismissal with regards to Savencia.
Yes, Your Honor. Right.
So you've got You've got 2 minutes.
Okay. So paragraphs 27 through 29 of the complaint lay out the beginning of the expectations and the conspiracy, if you'll forgive me, Your Honors. Whoops. The distribution agreement fraud is Savencia Cheese conspiring with the parties to gut rights that were given to ECB USA and Atlantic Ventures in the purchase agreement regarding preferences that they were entitled to. And we specify what the distribution agreement was, how it we were unaware of the fact that these rights were being taken from us, that they used Voss as their inside man, that he had a personal stake.
The complaint, though, is a little short on that fraud claim with regards to how those distribution, the favorable distribution agreements, for example, the discounts, were taken away. It says that it happened, but the complaint's not really clear about how that happened. Were they negotiated away? Were new contracts entered into?
A new agreement was entered into, and I believe it says a new distribution agreement that stripped all those rights.
Yeah, but we don't have any, there's no content to that. We don't know what that new agreement is or why it stripped it and what it maybe replaced it with.
Your Honor, replaced it with nothing. It took away those rights. But I would just say it's not a fraud count, right? It's an aiding and abetting count. And so that the claims as it relates to that don't fall to the same standard of pleading requirements. It's sufficient to put on notice a party on the other side that these rights were taken away. So, I mean, I just think it does meet it. If you look at the provisions of it, you'll see that we do plead that there was rights. They did exist in the original negotiation. They were taken. We were unaware of them.
What about just with respect to Savencia? When I look at the fraud allegations, I just see, it seems like you're sort of saying like this person did something. And then Savencia Cheese was like participated or was, I mean, where's like a specific allegation of fraud as specific to Savencia Cheese?
It's 155 allegations, Your Honor.
Yeah.
I hate to just formulate this generically.
Well, I mean, can you just give me one? Because, I mean, like I say, when I see, I feel like if I do a, I mean, I can't do it actually on a PDF, but if I did like a search find for Savencia Cheese, I just see a lot of stuff that says like these people like worked in concert and like Savencia Cheese like also did this and they acted in furtherance of this conspiracy. And it's just hard for me to find something that if you ask me like what did Savencia Cheese do, I have a hard time answering that question.
Well, so the answer to the question is that they conspired with Voss and the co-conspirators to take away through a new distribution agreement at the Schrader Savencia Cheese level that stripped rights that belonged to ECB USA without their knowledge of what was going on. Right.
So at its heart, it's sort of like a tortious interference claim. I mean, I know you make that's one claim.
Yeah, it's an aiding and abetting of a breach of fiduciary duty.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. It's Voss's breach, and we think it meets the pleading requirement standards for that breach of fiduciary duty count. But the good news is I get a rebuttal, so I'm going to grab the provisions that I think may be more helpful to you.
Okay, Mr. Marco, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Keneally.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Michael Keneally and I represent the defendants. This case is an offshoot, as Judge Covington was gesturing toward, of a long-running dispute over the 2014 sale of a New Jersey-based corporation, Schrader Foods. And the main litigation over this corporate transaction was initially brought in Florida State Court, but was removed and transferred to the District of Delaware through the Forum Selection Clause. And the parties are currently gearing up for trial in that action, which starts next month. And that action in Delaware involves the actual party to the stock purchase agreement, Zausner Foods, and it includes not just tort claims like fraud and conspiracy, but the type of contract claims you'd expect to see in a business dispute of this sort.
Let me ask you a question about the individual defendants here in the long arm jurisdiction. Tell me, why was the individual defendant sending documents with alleged misrepresentations into the virtual data room not a torturous act directed at Florida, given that the individual defendants knew appellant's deal counsel would access and review those misrepresentations in Florida as part of the due diligence process?
I think for several reasons, Your Honor, and I think it does help to sort of go sequentially through different periods of the sequence of events. So Mr. Marcos said that the fraud here began October 1st, 2014, and it wasn't until October, we don't know exactly when, of 2014, that the ECB representatives, that's the principals of the plaintiffs, not the plaintiffs themselves, hired Mr. Freeman in paragraph 78 of the amended complaint. So they did not know when they were initiating discussions with the ECB representatives that they would have deal counsel in Florida. That happened at that point. And at that point in time, the plaintiffs themselves, the Florida incorporated entities, did not even exist. They didn't exist until December. The data room that was set up in October of 2014, and this is from the original complaint, docket number one, was not just accessible to Mr. Freeman. It was accessible to the ECB representatives and to their consultants and their lawyers throughout a variety of locations.
Why does that matter?
Well, because it shows that the placing of documents in the data room wasn't directed to Mr. Freeman, wasn't directed to Florida. It was actually accessible, these are paragraphs 64 and 68 of the original complaint, across the whole world, depending on where the people involved in the deal with these foreign-based principals who were in Guadeloupe in the Caribbean, not even in the United States, and they were French nationals, that's where the data room was accessible.
Would be accessed by somebody in Florida.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Based on the allegations in the complaint, the defendants knew that the materials placed in the virtual data room would be accessed in Florida because the plaintiffs had local deal counsel in Miami, right?
Yes, by the attorney of the ECB representatives. And I think on this point—
So if you know that someone is going to be accessing data, how is that different than sending— assume there was no virtual data room and that in the old-fashioned way of decades ago, the defendants or those working for them had sent paper copies of every allegedly fraudulent document to everybody wherever they resided. And a set of those copies were sent to Mr. Freeman in Miami. And accepting the allegations and the complaint is true, some of those documents contained fraudulent representations or fraudulent statements, for example, about Mr. Voss. Why would there not be personal jurisdiction with respect to at least some of the defendants if the materials were sent the old-fashioned way in hard copy?
Well, I have two answers to that, Your Honor. One's a practical one and one's the doctrinal one. The practical one is that on a major corporate deal, the parties might have representatives, might have attorneys, and might have consultants across the entire country, might be in many countries. And if that mere sending of deal-related documents to their chosen agents who are not even employees or officers or investors in the company is enough to trigger personal jurisdiction, you really don't have much of a limitation in a transactional deal like that. And then, so to break it back more in terms of the doctrine, I would distinguish between the long-arm statute analysis and the due process analysis.
I'm not talking due process right now.
Okay, so let's just talk.
My question was meant long-arm.
Okay, just long-arm. So in the long-arm analysis, under this court's precedent, at a minimum, there needs to be, this is from Your Honor's opinion for the court in Del Valle, intentional conduct aimed at the forum state and caused harm that the defendant should have anticipated would be suffered in the forum state. Plaintiffs haven't alleged what harm their communications with Mr. Freeman caused in the state of Florida. At the time, they had no operations in the state of Florida. They had no officers, no property, no employees in Florida. So they don't have any injury in the state of Florida at the relevant time here. They began to transition Schrader Foods operations. Remember, these are two corporations, plaintiffs, ECB USA, and Atlantic Ventures that were formed for the purpose of this deal and to acquire Schrader Foods, which was based in New Jersey. The complaint alleges in paragraph 143, the amended complaint, that The decision to move Schrader from New Jersey to Florida was memorialized first in January of 2015. And it wasn't until 2017 by the amended complaints analysis in paragraph 62, that the completion of that move happened. So we don't know between 2015 and 2017 what, if any, injury occurred in Florida or was suffered in Florida. So even if we're just purely looking at this from the long arm statute analysis that this court has adopted, plaintiffs haven't satisfied the test. And again, I don't think that there's any plausible allegation that the individual defendants aimed anything at the state of Florida. This is very much unlike Expedia in that case, where Expedia was driving a substantial part of its revenue as a corporation from its Florida business, including with respect to the confiscated properties in that case. And here, there's no allegation that the individual defendants were driving revenue from Florida. So that's my answer on the long arm statute.
I think that's a good answer on sort of the first sort of aspect of the alleged fraud. It just seems to me like there's sort of two kinds of things here. They've alleged sort of like, sort of alleged pre-deal fraud and then like post-deal fraud, where they allege that, you know, there was this effort to sort of undermine the agreement that they had, and that there is that second, like sort of the back half of the fraud. Why isn't that enough for personal jurisdiction?
Similar reasons, Your Honor. There's no allegation in the complaint that plausibly ties the negotiation of that 2015 distribution agreement, if that's the part of it Your Honor is talking about, to Florida. In the appellate briefing that plaintiffs submitted, they assert that Voss was in Florida after the 2015 or the end of 2014 closure, but there are no allegations in the complaint. And I went back and looked at all of the paragraphs in the amended complaint cited about who was located where when, and Mr. Voss's location was never specified. At most, there are allegations that he spent some time in Florida, but not in, we don't know where he negotiated the distribution agreement or when exactly those acts occurred. And this should not have been a difficult factual allegation for plaintiffs to make, because remember, Mr. Voss was working for them during this post-closing period. He was in charge of the company they had just acquired. And so if they should know as well as anybody, certainly better than my clients, where Mr. Voss was located during the relevant period. But there aren't any allegations that he was operating in Florida. And again, the completion of the move of Schrader's headquarters to Florida didn't happen until 2017, years later. So we've been talking about the long arm statute. Of course, as Your Honors know, there's also the due process analysis. The Florida Supreme Court has itself said that that's a more restrictive analysis than the long arm statute. And I think my core takeaway for the due process point is the one that the Supreme Court identified as a problem in Walden versus Fiore, where the court specified that due process requires that a defendant be hailed into court in a forum state based on his own affiliation within the state, not based on the random, fortuitous, or attenuated contacts he makes by interacting with other persons affiliated with that state. And I think here, plaintiffs, their representatives' decision to hire a Florida-based deal counsel is a random, fortuitous, and attenuated contact with respect to defendants.
That statement can't be taken at face value, because if you have, unless I've completely misread personal jurisdiction law, if you have someone who crosses in from Florida to Georgia in a car and does so only for 5 minutes because he or she took a wrong turn somewhere and intends to go back into Florida, and during those 5 minutes causes an accident with someone on a Georgia highway, you've got specific personal jurisdiction, which is constitutionally okay. And that's a random, fortuitous act. The person never intended to go to Georgia, had no other contact with the state of Georgia, but caused a tort in the state of Georgia and probably could be hailed into court there, I would think.
Yes, I don't disagree with that, Your Honor. In that case, though, it's the defendant's action that created that contact to Florida. Here, it was plaintiff's action in retaining Miami-based deal counsel. And I think the best case I could identify on this exact point, how to interpret Walden with respect to sending emails to an attorney in the forum state, is the Eighth Circuit's decision in Peterson versus Frost. Although Mr. Marco did also identify the Medina versus Lorenzo case from the District of New Mexico, which is maybe the most factually analogous, where the plaintiff hired an attorney in the forum state, and the district court there said that doing that was not enough to satisfy due process. But in the Eighth Circuit case, the attorney at issue was actually the defendant's own attorney and the plaintiff in the action. And that plaintiff attorney had moved to Minnesota and said that the emails from the defendants to him in Minnesota, which were part of the alleged fraudulent scheme, were enough to establish personal jurisdiction in Minnesota. And the Eighth Circuit said that no, that was just the attorney's personal decision to relocate to Minnesota, but the defendants hadn't done anything to try to target Minnesota for any of their business dealings or anything like that. And so under Walden, the Eighth Circuit said that was not enough, and under the effects test, that wasn't enough. So I think that case is a harder case than our case, where, you know, Mr. Freeman's not a party to the transaction or the litigation, and he wasn't somebody we hired. He was somebody that the plaintiffs unilaterally hired and then required us to communicate with. And I'll just also note
Would this be different if the same facts, but there were negotiations that took place in Miami at the plaintiff's attorney's office?
I think it would be a much harder case, Your Honor. I can't say exactly without knowing all of the facts, but I think if there were actual negotiations alleged in Florida, it would be harder to see how that, at least for some of the defendants, you know, who participate in the, you know, here one of the issues we have is that there are five individual defendants and they're lumped all together in the complaint. But I do think that, you know, that's probably enough to, I don't know, I'd have to think more about it, but it's certainly a much closer case.
I guess, so, you know, because their argument is that this records room was sort of the equivalent of that, right? Is the sort of like, this is where the documents were exchanged. This is sort of this virtual, you know, you can envision if you go to a closing that there are documents pushed across a table and there's like in-person, you know, document review and stuff like that. And this was this sort of virtual record room. I guess it seems like, I mean, I think their strongest argument is that by putting something in that virtual space, knowing that there was a Florida attorney who was going to access that on behalf of the plaintiffs, that was the equivalent of like sort of coming to Florida to negotiate the deal. I mean, what do you say about that?
Well, two things. One is, I mean, our declarations say that the final deal negotiations took place in France. So I just don't think that's a colorable characterization of what happened here. But again, I also think that just practically speaking, if it's enough to have your attorneys, I mean, major law firms have, including my own, have offices all over the country, and they have attorneys working remotely. And if merely having a shared data room in a deal is enough to establish personal jurisdiction everywhere that one of those attorneys was working, I mean, that's a big open courtroom door across the country.
The documents said that closing would happen in Miami.
So, yes, I'm glad Your Honor brought that up because I wanted to identify the page of the this is document 41-6, page 50 out of 106, and here's the language. A closing of the transactions, shall be held on December 29th, 2014 at the offices of Morgan Lewis in Miami or remotely. And that's what happened. They were the closing here happened remotely. And I see I'm running low on time, but so I would.
Can you give him 2 minutes, please, Stephanie? Can you address the 12B6 dismissal with regards to Savencia, please?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. That was where I wanted to go. So I think the overarching problem with the plaintiff's claims against Savencia Cheese is that on key elements of each of the claims, the allegations, especially related to Savencia Cheese, which remember is one subsidiary of Zausner Foods and the one that entered into the distribution agreement. The allegations about Savencia Cheese itself are extremely thin and really just restate the elements of the claims in conclusory terms.
Let me ask you a question. Why wasn't Savencia Cheese's execution of the distribution agreement an overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy?
So I think for two reasons. So for the first reason is that the only agreement that plaintiffs in anywhere in the amended complaint identify involving Savencia Cheese itself is that 2015 distribution agreement. So the signing of that agreement isn't in furtherance of the agreement. It is the agreement. I think that's what the district court was getting at. But even setting that aside, I mean, under Florida conspiracy law, we cite the Tejera case, but it's not the only one that has said this. You know, conspiracy is in a freestanding claim. You also need the underlying wrong, and that needs to be plausibly pleaded. And with respect to Savencia Cheese, the wrongs that they're alleging underlie the conspiracies, fraud, constructive fraud, aiding and abetting fiduciary duty, none of those are plausibly alleged as to Savencia Cheese. Really at the core of their theory, Savencia Cheese wanted to get better pricing in its distribution agreement with Schrader, and that harmed Schrader supposedly. But that's just freedom of contract. That's just doing business. That's not a conspiracy or aiding and abetting a fiduciary breach. And with respect to fiduciary,
it can be, if you allege that one of the insiders in the new Schrader through EBC and Atlantic was somebody who had been previously controlled by others and really had no say in the running of Schrader before the acquisition. It becomes a little bit more plausible if you think of it that way.
Yeah, I understand, Your Honor. But again, Mr. Voss owned 45% of Schrader after the deal closed. And so the idea that he was undermining his own investment, substantial investment, by breaching his fiduciary duties to the company he owned 45% of, you'd have to have some factual substance behind that theory. And especially when this is a typical arm's length business transaction between a distributor and a counterparty under Woods versus Barnett Bank of Fort Lauderdale, you need to have some more factual substance behind the allegations to show that what was actually happening wasn't freedom of contract, but was aiding and abetting some sort of fiduciary breach or other comparable wrongdoing.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. So to answer your question, Your Honor, it's paragraph 36, and I'm sure you sort of summarized it back to me, so that's probably where you were looking, and respectfully, we believe that lays out a sufficient amount of allegations to satisfy 12b-6, considering it is not the heightened standard. It is simply to put a party on notice as to who the parties were, what they were doing, what the actual violation of law was. To Judge Covington's point, the distribution agreement is not the fraud. The fraud is the distribution agreement is the result of the fraud. And whether or not Savencia Cheese had a freedom of contract has nothing to do with the fact that Mr. Voss, as the inside man, traded those rights away behind the back of ECB because they had separate and secret agreements with him to compensate him for his dirty deeds. And that is pled into the complaint. He even got a percentage for pretending that he was CEO of the company. He was supposed to receive 25% of the sale of Corman. It's written into the, it's pled into the amended complaint. He was compensated well. And to argue whether or not those pleadings are sufficient without counter affidavits to contradict any of it defies the principle that, as alleged, they are accepted as true for purposes of a motion to dismiss. And the one thing I would like to sort of articulate to the court that I think I failed to do in the beginning is that when this fraud began in 2014 and continued, this court looks to where injury occurred. And the simple fact that payments were made in both 2014 and 2015 from Miami, Florida, from bank accounts in Miami, Florida, alone satisfies the requirements of establishing personal jurisdiction. It is where the injuries occurred. They happened right here in this town, right? So at the end of the day, Your Honors, we think that we have satisfied the requirements.
If Schrader and ECB and Atlantic had never, ever moved to Florida, would your argument be the same?
Oh, absolutely, because Mr. Freeman is not a casual person, and he is an agent of a disclosed principal. He is the same as the principal. So when he is in Miami, Florida, and he is the person that held those signatures, that escrowed those documents, that distributed those monies, that reviewed the frauds that were in the data room on behalf of our client, among others, right, in and outside the state of Florida, it's not possible to say, well, there's Freeman, and there's the plaintiff representatives, and there's the plaintiffs. Freeman equals them, right? So the Cruz case that we cite, which is a Florida court case, says that an attorney is an agent of a principal, right? There's no daylight between the two of them. So Mr. Freeman is as much a party.
How do you cause injury to Mr. Freeman?
He's the agent of a principal.
So he stands in shoes of the principal for a lot of things, but he doesn't stand in the shoes of the principal for injury tort purposes.
He's not the plaintiff, but he distributed the money on behalf of our client from Miami, Florida. Our clients paid money into Miami and out of Miami. And to say that that it's sort of a random concept and that he's a satellite off in outer space, which is essentially how our friends on the other side are characterizing this, doesn't really capture the agency-principal relationship that's going on here. He was our deal counsel. The deal was to close in Miami, Florida. A virtual closing in Miami doesn't occur by bots. It occurs by human beings. Mr. Freeman received those documents. He paid the money in Florida. The injury occurred in Florida. And the 11th Circuit has held repeatedly. It has held it in Posner, where an injury occurred in Florida. Your Honor and DeValle stated, if the injury occurred in Florida, it satisfies the requirements of 1B under the long-arm statute. And that is all that we need to do, right, is demonstrate just injury alone.
Okay, Mr. Marco, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Thank you both.